all of it is true. Boys and girls, it is a pleasure to be here at the yeshiva in Boca Raton, Florida. I came today to teach you fundamentals. There's a rabbi called Maimonides, Harambam. I know you heard of him. I'm sure you learned about him. Maimonides has 13 principles of faith. Every Jew, according to Maimonides, must believe in the 13 Ikare Emunah. If you don't know what they are, in most of the Sidurim that you use, after Shachrit, after Alinu Neshabeya, there's a list of all 13. I recommend that you take a look at them. Because according to Maimonides, if you don't believe even in one of them, so then you're considered a defector. And you forfeit your rights as a Jew. There's nothing to be nervous about. You probably believe in all 13, even without having to see the list. However, there was a rabbi that lived after Harambam. His name was Rabbi Yosef Albo. He wrote a book called Sefer HaIkarim, the Book of Principles. And in this masterpiece, today they have it in two volumes, he argues on Maimonides. And he says, although the 13 principles are very important, but the real principles can be capitulated to three. There are three Ikare Emunah. In this short talk, we do have enough time to review the three principles which would be considered the fundamentals and the foundations of Judaism, and all of you will be able to take a litmus test and you'll be able to ponder and contemplate and ask yourself while I'm talking, do I believe in these principles? This is a good yardstick, a good measure, barometer, to know exactly where you're standing. The good news is you're going to learn the three principles. I'm embarrassed to tell you most people have no clue what these are. So today is your lucky day. Principle number one. The world was created by God, and His presence is still amidst. Let's review. That's the first pasuk in our Torah. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim et haaretz. To be Jewish, one must believe that there is a creator. Today in the scientific world or in the colleges, they refer to it as divine design. That's fine. Divine means a God. That is essential. But to be honest, it's very easy to believe that there's a creator. If somebody brings me a book, the logical conclusion is that there's an author to the book. A book can't just happen. The 500 pages of Julius Caesar, Romeo and Juliet, cannot happen by taking ink and just splattering it against the canvas and all of a sudden you have a bestseller. Thought must go into the book in every sentence and every paragraph. Now, mind you, as sophisticated a book is, it's nowhere near as complex as a blade of grass, which the greatest scientists and inventors cannot even duplicate yet. That's how complex it is. So to say that a blade of grass or the human eye or the sun and the moon and the galaxies or the oceans or the mountains just happened. Things don't just happen. That's saying that you have a tall building, 50 floors, with a plan, with a layout, with rugs, with lighting, with plumbing. Somebody comes along and says, who built this? No, it just appeared. There was a storm one day, and slats of metal were flying all over the place, and pipes and wires, and all of a sudden it just appeared. You say, this is ludicrous. If there's a building, there must be a builder. That's logical. It's got nothing to do with religion. And if somebody takes you to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and you see some of the most beautiful pictures, the most beautiful artwork, it is clear that there must be a painter. If you look on the right side, usually towards the bottom, the painter signs his name. That's indicative that this was done with thought. It had to be planned. And take the most complex painting, it's nowhere near the most simple organism on this earth. And therefore, one rabbi once said, and I think he's right, Rabbi Avigdor Miller, his name is, he said, it takes more faith not to believe in God than to believe in God. To believe in God is logical. It doesn't take any faith. It's common sense. But to believe, as I'll discuss some of the theories with you then. There's one theory that there was a big explosion. Today they call that the Big Bang Theory. There was a big explosion of some sort. And as a result of the explosion, and many explosions, came this world. I don't know about you, but when we turn on the news, and we hear about explosions in Afghanistan or explosions in Iraq, usually the result of an explosion is negative. We don't hear that there was an explosion by the police station in Afghanistan and now we're seeing tennis courts and swimming pools and gardens. It doesn't usually happen that way. The result of an explosion is usually destructive. It doesn't make something more productive. So that theory of a Big Bang Theory is hard to conceptualize just from a logical standpoint, just from the way we think. Today the theory that they talk about in the colleges as well is evolution. Let's review evolution for a second. In evolution, Darwin was one of the founders of the idea, and he said like this. He said in Latin, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, if you learned that in science. Basically what he meant to say is survival of the fittest. And his example was that you had these polar bears in the Arctic, the cold places, and the early polar bears didn't have fur, so they died out. And the species was dying out, and all of a sudden, by no choice, just to survive, they adapted. And how did they adapt? They grew fur. So the most fit of the polar bears continued to exist, and the weaker ones died out. So it was a process of millions of years till the polar bears got smart to grow fur. This is what he said. But how did they know to grow fur? No, it was just something that happened by itself, out of necessity. So I say, based on that theory, if we go to the Empire State Building, I'm sure you heard of it, it's a tall building in Manhattan, and we start throwing horses off the Empire State Building. I'm assuming that after 1 million or 2 million horses, they'll start growing wings and adapt and fly away. Most of you have a smirk, a sarcastic smirk, as if to say, what are you talking about? You don't believe that's going to happen. Well, that's what they're telling you. And I ask a very simpler question, more simpler question. How come we don't see any adaptations today? Why did it stop? Why did it stop?
You do see
adaptations. Oh, I'd like to know. I'm not challenging. First, I'm talking with respect. So you don't have to raise your voice. I'm talking with respect. Explain it to me and I'll analyze it. Where do we see an adaptation?
We see in various caves there are fish that have become all white and their eyes, where there would have been eyes, it's covered by skin.
Can I ask you a simple question? Did we see the fish before? In our lifetime, we saw these fish, but this is a theory.
They have been taken out of the caves and bred in the light for several generations. Their eyes have opened up, they have reformed
eyes. Is that a result of adaptation, or is that a result that they're doing something to the fish to cause it to mutate?
No, it's adaptation. The only thing they've done is move them from darkness in the caves.
Okay, so that's good news to me then. You know why it's good news to me? I'll tell you why it's good news to me. I'm glad you're telling me that. Because according to that, I carry a cell phone, and I also carry in my other hand usually a drink or a cup of coffee. Most of the time I'm on the computer, and I do not have a third hand for a mouse. But in probably 100,000 years or 200,000 years, because that's how long it usually takes, or maybe more, humans will probably grow a third hand from the side of their body in order to deal with all the electronics. So to me, it's good news that fish can adapt, but I haven't seen a human yet adapt. That being said, and I'll look it up, by the way, and I'll take your phone number, and this conversation will continue, because that's very vital information for you. Now, let's continue. So to believe that there's a creator, it's something that's logical, it's something that makes sense, especially that the world runs in an order. It runs in a system. Sunrise can be predicted tomorrow morning exactly when it's going to rise. And if you look in the newspaper, they'll tell you to the second when it's going to set. Things that do not have a manager don't run in a system. Things that don't have somebody overseeing them run randomly. The train system, as many managers that they have and as many personnel that they have, they still have a difficult time in getting the train to come in at 7:27 like it says on the schedule. But could you imagine if they didn't have any oversight? If it was just run by itself, it would be 100 times more or 1,000 times more confusion. So the order of the world, the fact that it keeps a certain system, is an indication that somebody is behind it. Now that's a principle of Yahadut. Somebody that believes as an evolution that it happened by itself, without a God. Or in a Big Bang theory that happened godless, that already is contempt of Judaism. So therefore you have to look deep down in your hearts and you must commit, I believe, in a creator. Now there's one B to this. And one B is just as important as one A. The creator is still involved in the world. He didn't create it and leave. There are theories that say that God created it however many years ago, and He's not involved in the day-to-day. It's too mundane for God to deal with the goings-on on earth. He's up there in the heavens somewhere in meetings at very, very important high-level discussions, but He really has no clue what's going on earth. 1B, says Rabbi Yosef Albo, is Hashkaha. There's divine intervention and divine knowledge that God is aware and is involved in supervising the day-to-day events of man. God, as a matter of fact, knows that we're giving this class here in Boca Raton. And according to our tradition, when there are 10 men and righteous women in a room like we are today, the presence of God is manifest on a higher level. As an example of Hashkaha, as an example, it's important that we see the hand of God in our lives. I started I call it a game that I do at my Friday night table with my children, because I want to drill into them that there is God in your life, but you just have to look, you have to find them. So the rules are that every Friday night at the Shabbat table, you must tell me a story how you saw the hand of God in your life. In the beginning, they didn't see it. They didn't know what the rules were. They didn't know how to find it. But now I tell you, every Friday night, each one has a story. Mina shamayim, this was supposed to happen, and I was waiting for this, and so on and so forth. So 2 weeks ago, one of the children got up and told the following story. He says, "Dad, it's not my story, but I read it in the book, and my teacher confirmed that she knows the person that this happened to." So you don't have to trace it back, you know, 7 levels back to Moshe Rabbeinu. It's the teacher that related to the student that knows the person that this happened to. And then my son happened to read it in the book. Ladies in Israel, she's coming home from work. It's usually a 20-minute drive from where she works to go home. She's already preparing what she's going to make for dinner. She's thinking how she's going to have to do the homework for her children, so on and so forth. As she's driving, all of a sudden the traffic hits, standstill. Not normal traffic, standstill. Doesn't know what to do. After a couple of minutes, she figures that there must have been an accident. Something in her mind clicked that she should take out a Tehillim book and start reading. So she took out a Tehillim book, but she doesn't know who she's even praying for. But she says, if somebody's in danger and somebody's, God forbid, fatal, an accident, I'm going to read this Tehillim. And she's reading, and she's reading with fervor, and one chapter after another chapter. She was so engrossed that the traffic started moving, and she was just stuck in place, so they had to honk, and thought, okay, lady, you know, you can start going. So she goes. She gets to the accident. She was right. And she turns around. She sees there's an ambulance. There's cop cars. And she sees them actually bringing a lady in a stretcher. But she's driving by now quickly. She says, he looks familiar. I don't recognize her. And she can use going. She comes home. She tells everybody, well, you don't know what happened today. Accident on the highway. What were you doing, man, in the car the whole time? Listening to the radio? No, I was reading Tehillim, and she just mentioned it casually. 3 months later, she goes to open school. She comes to open school, she's talking to all the teachers, there's other parents that are there. Lady comes to her and says, by the way, I've been meaning to speak to you. She says, okay, is everything okay? And the lady thinks, she looks so familiar, this lady. I know her from somewhere. She says, well, I don't know if you heard, but I was in a near-fatal accident. She says, what? I don't believe that. That's who you are. I knew you. I was there that day on the highway. I saw them putting into, wow, you're alive. It was so grim. I can't, you look, miracles of miracles. But now let me tell you what happened. And mind you, these are not the most religious, pious, people that have their heads in the clouds. These are regular, we'll call them mainstream, middle-of-the-road people. Says, let me tell you what happened. Says, they took me into the ambulance. I was out. My soul was above my body. I was able to see everything that was happening to me from above. And I started to, everything was pleasant. No hardship, nothing scary. My soul was levitating to higher levels, and it was a light, and I was being drawn to the light. And as I was rising to different places, I saw Malachim. I guess they were angels. I never saw an angel before, but it was some pleasurable experience that I was having. And all of a sudden, coming towards me, I see words of Tehillim. I see words, Pesukim of Tehillim, coming towards me. And as the Tehillim are coming towards me, my neshama, instead of going up, is being magnetized towards the words of the Tehillim. And the Tehillim are shooting at me these letters, and I'm looking down. She says, I didn't want to come back down. I was happy where I was going. I was comfortable. I felt good. But the Tehillim was drawing me down, and as I'm coming down and down, I'm saying, what is going on? What are these words? And I start to look, and I look, and I see all the cars on the highway. And I see a car, and from that car, there's words of Tehillim shooting up directly towards me, and I look in the windshield, and I see you there. You're sitting there with your book of Tehillim. And lo and behold, my neshama came so low that all of a sudden I hear the doctors that were working on me. And I hear them saying, we have a pulse. And at that moment, I jittered a little. Says, I just came to thank you. You don't know what your Tehillim did for me that day. I know it was you. I saw it. I'm not a voodoo person. I don't get into this type of stuff. But nobody could tell me what I saw and what I didn't see. And therefore the Tehillim works. To me, when I heard that story from my son, that's indicative to me that there's a God. And there's a God that reacts to our prayers, and he hears our prayers. And the prayers are directed to the address that the prayers are made. And here you have a lady in Israel that's telling you, I'm a product of that. I saw it. I am a survivor as a result of the Tehillim. And she had all the details accurate as it happened. So there's Hashkacha. Look for God in your lives, children. Not always it's going to be such a dramatic miracle. It's not always such a great story like that. Sometimes it's going to be something where you're just going to have in your mind, you know, I need to speak to so-and-so. How many times has this happened to you? I need to speak to so-and-so. All of a sudden, that moment they call. So I don't believe I'm just thinking about you. Or you need to look for somebody. All of a sudden you bump into the person at the market. This happens more times than none, where people come along and they've made phrases like, oh, it's a small world. They're wrong. It's a very big world. But there's God. And when there's God, things like that happen. Hashkacha. God arranges these meetings. God willing, I think you'll see it most clear. You girls and boys are graduating high school. I know you're not thinking about getting married yet, but in a few years, that'll be already on your mind. You'll see the miracle of how you're going to meet your spouse. Even the agnostic, even the one that questions, but when they think about how they met their spouse, that it was min hashamayim. I was happened to be there, but I wasn't supposed to be there, and I went there by mistake, and she was really supposed to be in a different place, and she came over there, and we bumped into each other, and really, everybody has a story. And therefore, when you start to develop, you'll see that God is indeed micromanaging. He's next to you and He's close to all of us. He's a creator that's involved. You see, the one that created this, I guess we'll call it a lectern, he's God. He's not thinking about the lectern. He's not aware of the fact that we're using it. He's not involved in anything to do with its maintenance. He created it. It was delivered, and he moved on. But God is not like that. God is a creator that's intimately involved in every day-to-day, second-to-second detail. Number two. Number two is, we must believe in the principle that our Torah is divine. Torah min ha-shamayim. Our Torah is not like another book that is synthetic. We live in the United States. We have a constitution. The constitution is a man-made document. It was made by, albeit smart, founding fathers, they call them. But it was made by people. Therefore, since it was made by people, it must have mistakes. Therefore, the Constitution is constantly amended, it's constantly changed, it's constantly updated. There's one book in the world that is flawless, has stood the test of time, it's been the bestseller since the day it's been delivered to earth, and that is our Bible. And it was not written by man, it was not written by a publishing house, this is the Word of God. This is His book. And therefore, we spend our lives trying to understand the deepest of all books, because His wisdom is infinite, and therefore His book is going to be infinite in knowledge. Things that are written in this book, only a God can predict and only a God could know. As an example, I want to ask you a question. Where did they get the concept of 30-day months? Where did that come from? A month is 30 days. Well, it's science. Month, man is moon. It's based on a lunar calculation. As you know, the moon waxes and wanes. It takes about 29.5 and change days, 29 and a half days, rounded off to 30, for the moon to make one full waxing and waning, for it to reach full moon on the 15th. That's when you have full moon, that's when all the lunatics come out. That's why they call them lunatics, because it's lunar, it's affected by the moon. And then it takes another 15 days for it to disappear. This happens every month. So they made a measure of time called a month. Well, that one you got. Okay, where did they get Where did they get a year from? What's a year based on? 365 days, what is it based on? Very good, it's a solar cycle. Very simple. The earth, and this can be debated, but let's take it this way. The earth makes revolution around the sun. It takes the earth 365 days for it to make one complete revolution. That's called a year. 365 days represents something that you could document, something that you could take out your telescopes and you could monitor it. Here's the sun. 1 year from now, the sun comes back to its original position. One revolution around the sun is a shana. Perfect. What's a day? Where did they get 24-hour days from? Very good. The moon is involved in a double spin, as you know. Besides it revolving around the sun, the moon itself is spinning on its axis. It spins. Right now we're spinning. You don't feel it. It's a very smooth ride. But do you know how fast the earth is spinning? Take a guess. How fast is the earth spinning right now? About 1,000 miles an hour. On a plane, the plane travels like 500, 600 miles an hour. You feel a little turbulence. The captain says, put your seatbelts on. Everybody sit down. Here you're spinning 1,000 miles an hour. You never walk in the street and those say, whoa, whoa. It's a smooth ride. Now that 1,000 miles an hour spin, since the diameter of the earth, if you go from one point to the next, it's 20 hours for the earth to make one revolution. Spinning 1,000 miles an hour, 24 hours is 24,000 miles, and then it gets right back to where it goes. So it's spinning like this, and it's spinning around the... So a day basically is science. You can see it. Take out the Hubble telescope, look at the moon, and you'll see it spinning. It's proven, it's documented. Good. So you tell me a day is science. You told me a month is science. You told me a year is science. My final question, and I know you have to go, but there's much more to say. I need to get to the third one. Imagine if I attempted to tell you the 13 principles of Maimonides. Where did they get a week from? A 7-day week. Go, all the hachamim, go, answer. 7-day week. Where's it from? 7-day week. What is it? What is it commemorating? What is it? What scientific?
7 days of creation.
Whoa, creation. Oh, you're religious. You're religious. It's creation. Whoa, slow down. Creation. I'm an atheist. What's creation? What are you talking about? I'm in Harvard now. I'm a professor in Harvard. Now I want to know, what is the 7-day? So you tell me, well, not everybody has 7 days. But show me a society that has 7 days. In Kenya, they have a 7-day week. In Poland, they have a 7-day week. Syria, we have a 7-day week.
Syria.
They did, but they went back to a 7-day. French also. You're right, you know so much, but they went back. They went back to a 7-day. Today, nobody has a 10-day week. But guess what? If I was making the calendar, I would have made it like you, a 10-day, 30-day month. So make 3 weeks of, 10 days. Perfect. Why make 4 weeks remainder two? It's lopsided. Or make 5-day weeks. Make 6 weeks in the month, 5 days. Or make 6 days. So, but it's even. It's 5 weeks of 6 days where it's an even number. Who decided 7 days and the whole world is following it? Nobody even has an 8-day week. There's only one source. There's only one source. Wasn't invented by government. It's the first page of the Bible. Ki sheshet yamim asa Adonai et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-ares u-bayom ha-shivi'i Shabbat ve-yinafash. Because the world was created in 6 days, on the 7th day, it's called the Sabbath, God rested. The only source is from the Bible. That means the whole world, all these atheists and all these agnostics and all these deniers of God, but you tell them, what comes after Saturday? No, new week. Sunday, what is new week? Where'd you get that from? Where are you getting that from? Oh, it must be some calculation that Mars makes a revolution. Nothing to do with Mars. It's got nothing to do with Pluto, it's got nothing to do with Venus. It comes from the Torah. And the world is living according to that divine truth. If the people would only open their eyes and they would start to realize how much this world is bound by this divine book. Keep in mind, and I will conclude. Keep in mind, until the 1600s, where you had Galileo, most of the scientific world believed, and I would have believed with them, that the world was flat. Makes sense to say the world is flat. And they believe you just walk and walk and walk, and eventually you'll just fall off the world. It ends. As a matter of fact, the early Greeks believed that an earthquake, they explained it as if the earth is being supported by four huge elephants, and when the elephants sneeze, that creates a tremor. You laugh, go check it up. And those were the Hachamim of Yavan. Oh, and they said that, everybody said, wow, so very smart. They kissed the guy's hand when he said that. Today we laugh, today it's comical. Because today we know, with the telescopes that we have, that the world is round. But do you know that 3,000 years ago, there was a rabbi called Rabbi Shimon, little less, 2,500 years ago. And he wrote a book called the Zohar HaKadosh. We have the Zohar HaKadosh. You've heard of Zohar. And you know, he writes over there, as a matter of fact, I can show you the Zohar HaKadosh. He says clearly, the world is round. There are those that live on top, and there are those that live on the bottom. Interesting. That means Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai must have known about gravity as well. Because how could people live on top and stand on their feet and live on the bottom and stand on their feet? Unless there's a type of force, a gravitational force, that's keeping them grounded. And he says that the times on the top of the ball are different than the times on the bottom of the ball. When it's light on top, it's dark on the bottom, and vice versa. And then Rabbi Shimon says, and the people that are living on the other side, they look different than us. I know Rabbi Shimon never was in China or Japan. But he came along in one piece of Zohar. So progressive our Torah is. So advanced our Torah is. You shouldn't think kids, now Torah is antiquated. Torah is old-fashioned. The Torah is regressive. The Torah is something, you know, passé. On the contrary, usually it takes science an average of 5,000 to 6,000 years to catch up with the modernity of our Torah. Now, it's a matter of fact, of course the world is round. Okay, we're taking it. We've been saying that for 3,000 years. Where have you been? Oh, now we have a picture to prove it. We don't need a picture. We had a tradition all the way from Sinai that the world is round. And guess what? When you start to study our Torah, you'll see it's divine, and everything there is truthful, like we call it a Torah Emet. And you start to see that you don't have to be embarrassed of our Torah. On the contrary, our Torah is cutting edge. Everything is in it. Nobody should think, oh, it's an old Hebrew book. You know, today we follow the New England Journal of Medicine. That's much more authentic, or that much more authoritative. You're wrong. That's theory. New England Journal of Medicine gives theory. This is not theories, these are facts. But you never open the book to study it, so you won't be aware of these marvels that are in the Torah itself. So again, we got 2 out of 3. 2 out of 3 is not bad, as they say. Number one, there's a creator, which is obvious. And the creator is involved. That's divine intervention. God is here. God is with us. And number two, our Torah is written by God. It's a divine book. It's flawless. And all the secrets of the world, some of them that they don't even realize they're following, like the 7-day week, are all based on a Torah. And therefore, instead of investing so much time on novels, stories that never happened, things that are fictitious and in the land of make-believe, spend your time studying this book of God, which is the ultimate truth, which is the ultimate road to perfection. And that is my message to you. The third one happens to be, just for the record, that God rewards us for our good deeds. You have to believe that you're going to get rewarded for the fact that you came here today. And I'm very, very impressed by your decorum. I go all over the country to speak. I'm looking at your eyes. Your eyes are on me. I'm looking at your concentration. To get kids today in high school to sit for a half hour as you have done, it is truly remarkable. It is a testimony to your teachers, it is a testimony to the values that this yeshiva has given you, to your parents, to... And I go back to New York very impressed of the way, even the intellect, which I'm going to confirm, Be'ezrat Hashem, and double check, but with respect, I'm very impressed. Guess what? You're going to get reward for this. One day, the Creator is going to come along and say, you remember Rabbi Mansur came and he taught Torah for a half hour, and you were listening and you were thinking, and that's studying Torah. You get reward for studying Torah. They're going to give you a payout for that. And it's an eternal payout. And at that time, when they're paying you out, I'm going to come to you in Gan Eden. I'm going to say, I told you, I told you. You didn't think you're going to get reward. And guess what? Your reward is going to be eternal. So I'm going to come to you and haunt you eternally. Every time you're going to be basking in the Gan Eden, wherever you're going to come, I told you, see that for a half hour of studying Torah in the middle of November? Look at the reward you're taking because of it. You must believe in that. There's reward for the tzaddikim, for the good deeds that they do. Thank you very much, and have a good day.